Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of Housefeld's Collective Cast. I'm here this morning with Anthony Mayton, Nicola Boyle and Luke Streatfeild. We've got two main issues to discuss, although a lot has been happening in the collective actions field, all to be covered in future episodes. The first thing we want to cover is the CPO hearing in the Google Play Store case. The second thing, and the thing we'll spend most time on, is the Court of Appeals judgment in the trains cases. So, Luke, I'm going to come to you first on the Google Play Store CPO hearing. I think I'm right in saying it was a half day.
That's correct.
And the most notable thing, you'll tell me if this is wrong, but Google didn't actually oppose certification.
So this was welcome. I think we always said it was the kind of case that ought to have been certified. And it's interesting, in both the Apple App Store proceedings, which are similar in structure, and the Google Play Store proceedings, that there's been no serious opposition to certification from either defendant when it has got to the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
There was initial opposition in both cases, but when it got close to the hearing, both of those defendants dropped their objections to certification, and Google didn't even appear in opposition. Now, what this means from a practice perspective, and I think is quite interesting, is that even though there was no adversarial challenge, the tribunal took on the role of kind of the inquisitor in this case, and they picked up on some points that had been made by Google mm-hmm. in relation to certification and wanted to satisfy themselves about it on a kind of inquisitorial basis by asking questions at the half-day hearing on the funding side, on the insurance side. And they also wanted to ask some of their own questions about the expert evidence. And so our expert gave oral evidence at the certification hearing on those questions. And there, you had a bit of advance notice from the tribunal about the questions, and then some additional questions on the day. And that is slightly unusual for practitioners who are used to the adversarial system, mm-hmm. where you have the case against you, and then, although you don't know what questions are going to come on the day in cross-examination, you know what the issues are between the parties. This is a slightly different way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, in terms of the way in which you prepare for the hearing, all that different in the end, because you have to cover the issues and you know what you need to show the tribunal. And the tribunal was good in giving advance notice of the kind of issue you'd have to face.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so judgment is awaited?
And judgment there is awaited. There was an indication at the hearing that the case would be certified, but we're awaiting judgment. And so hopefully we'll get that before long.
And Luke, do you think this is the sort of direction of travel now, that this is settling down into what we might start to expect of certification hearings?
Well, hopefully, because I think we've seen a lot of cases that have been well organised and properly set up for, you know, to be certified as collective proceedings coming through. And naturally, defendants have wanted to test a lot of issues, but mm-hmm. they have been dealt with. And you know, provided that good cases come forward and they have been properly mm-hmm. put together, hopefully this certification stage will be a much more administrative hearing. And it won't take so much time and it won't take so much cost.
And hopefully they will now move forward quicker.
Exactly. So that we can get on with the main substantive hearings in these cases, which we're, you know, really looking forward to today.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks, Luke. And so the main thing, as I said, that we want to cover in this episode is the Court of Appeals judgment in the trains cases being brought by Justin Gutman. We had the judgment from the Court of Appeal late last month. I think, Luke, I'm right in saying this is a really important ruling. It deals with some significant issues. Do you want to take us through what you think are the main points?
Absolutely. So this, the trains case, is an example of how the cases were dealt with before we got to these much smoother certification hearings. First, it was held in a siding because of merits, and while that went up the Supreme Court. And now we had our certification last year, and it then has, the certification decision has been appealed, and there were four grounds of appeal before by the defendants, and we had our appeal hearing in June, and now we have our judgment. And here in this case, we act alongside our co-counsel, Charles Linden, in trying to push these cases forward. And it's been, I think, slightly frustrating, certainly for our client, Justin Gutman, and for us, that it's taken so long to get to a point where all the certification issues are dealt with. But it's been worth the wait, because the issues that were taken by the defendants, some were of great importance, some were of lesser importance. But the Court of Appeal judgment, consistent with its approach in BT, was very clear and very quick. And I think we can see from that the first point to draw out is that the Court of Appeal clearly is exercising its gatekeeper function, if you want to call it that, with great care and promptness. And so this has been just that speed and the clarity with which both those judgments have come out be very good for the regime. But on the substance, there are four grounds of appeal. The defendants took lots of points, but there were two that are really important. And the first one is the one that's really critical to the regime generally. And this was that the defendants were saying in this case that under the collective proceedings regime, it was clear from the statutory regime that you could deal with damages on an aggregate basis. But it was not the case that you could just deal with issues of liability on an aggregate basis. They said they had rights of defense to test potentially every individual who might be in the class. In this case, they might have a different story as to why they might or might not have bought a boundary pair. The case is all about boundary pairs and whether or not customers would willingly have paid twice for a section of their journey that they had a travel card for when they were traveling out of London. Their travel card would allow them to travel for that part of the journey, and they should only be having to pay for the fare from the edge of where their travel card allowed them to travel from. The defendants were saying that there might be any number of reasons why an individual in question might not have bought a boundary fare. And so they should be entitled to exercise their rights of defence to test that in any individual case. And the Court of Appeal looked at this, and probably the high point of their case was that the statute, the relevant statutory provision, doesn't say that liability can be dealt with on an aggregate basis. And they really emphasised this, and they said, look, it can't have been the intention of the statutory regime to allow liability to be dealt with in this way, because it didn't say so. And the Court of Appeal looked at the statute and said that it really needed to be interpreted purposively to allow this regime to work. And it seems obvious that if you can deal with damages on an aggregate basis, if you still had to deal with liability on an individual basis, you'd still have millions of individual trials. You'd be back in kind of GLO territory again. And that's not what the collective regime is supposed to do.
And I think Council made the point, Luke, that if you did do it that way, you'd sort of be there for years.
Yes, potentially. Which is a slight argument in extremis, but it nevertheless highlights the point nicely. That the purpose of this regime is to allow access to justice for small claims that otherwise were not being brought, where competition harms are causing harm in the market, and you need an ability to get redress for people who've been affected in a practical way that works, and also to act as a deterrent. And the argument by the defendants, while obviously on all fours legally, you know, they said the statute doesn't say you can do liability on an aggregate basis, it made no sense for the regime. And it was a really welcome approach from the Court of Appeal to take a really common sense, purposive approach to interpretation of the statute. But they also put the decision on really firm legal grounds as well by referring to the merits case. And the point that Lord Justice Green drew out is that the merits case dealt with pass on. And in one sense, that relates to damages, but it also relates to liability. Because if you have passed on your loss, ultimately, then you don't have a claim. And so that goes to liability of the defendant. And so it's all wrapped up together and you can't separate them out artificially. And they referred to the merits case, which is a Supreme Court decision, and to the Lloyd and Google case that also considered this. And so it felt like a very strong judgment from that front and a really clear indication that this is the way the Court of Appeal sees the regime as working.
It's another really refreshing judgment by Green again, I think. And as you say, and it's very strong. It roots this point both in the decisions in the Supreme Court in Merricks and Lloyd. It looks at statutory construction. It looks at the Canadian judgments, distinguishes that regime, and comes up with a very clear position on liability. And as you rightly say, it was a clear attempt by the defendants to effectively destroy the regime, because if you've got to look at liability, not damages issues, on an individual basis, you can never make the regime operate. So it's extremely good to have this very clear view from the Court of Appeal. I would hope on this point the defendants choose not to appeal, but if they do, I would hope the Supreme Court kick it back and say, look, we've already looked at this, Court of Appeal has interpreted it, end of story. But anyway, very good on this point.
Great. And then I think I'm right in saying there was also some important clarification when it comes to the application of the Microsoft test to the methodology.
Absolutely. So this is one more for the lawyers, for the practitioners, less for the general public who are affected by the regime. But there was a challenge here to the expert methodology, which our client had relied on for the purposes of certification. And this expert methodology had sought to draw together the data that was available, and not all the data in this case is publicly available at all. And in certain cases, the defendant says it's not going to be available, it just doesn't exist. And so you have to make certain assumptions to come up with a methodology for assessing damages on an aggregate basis. What had been gathered was survey evidence from the train companies before the claim was filed. And so there was evidence that had been put forward, but the defendants said that there were still gaps and there were assumptions, and it relied on a common sense assessment that people wouldn't have willingly paid twice for a ticket, where they had a ticket that was valid for a part of the journey, they wouldn't willingly have paid twice for that part of the journey. And there was also some evidence that still needed to be gathered. There was a survey that had come up at the certification hearing that our client's expert said he would like to do, and the defendant said, well, that's not good enough then. You haven't done the work you needed to do at the certification stage to complete your evidence. And again, the Court of Appeal took a really common sense approach here, and they said that you don't need to have covered off every detail. What you need is a reasonable methodology. And it was an example of the Microsoft test. The test hasn't changed from this judgment. It's interesting for practitioners to see how it's going to be applied in practice. And I think the outcome, the take-home point, is that it's a really common sense approach. It's not that everything will be waved through. There was evidence that was gathered in advance, all the evidence that was available to support the methodology, and it had been put together very carefully, and our client's expert was cross-examined by the tribunal at the certification hearing in great detail. The defendants, following that cross-examination or inquisition from the tribunal, chose not to ask any further questions at that hearing. We can't speculate as to why they chose to do that or not to do that, but that also was a factor in the Court of Appeal's decision in saying that you had your opportunity to test this, and it's been very thoroughly scrutinised, and we think that the right approach is to take this common sense approach and say that the work that's been done today is sufficient, and of course it's going to be supplemented and improved at trial, but it's not that you have to have covered off every little detail at the certification stage.
Mm-hmm. And Luke, the Broad Act made an appearance.
The Broad Act turns out now is an adjustable act.
Yeah.
And so this was something that was novel from the Court of Appeal judgment. But again, welcome. I mean, the judgment was a very good read, and I'm not sure that I can do justice to the concept of the adjustable acts. But I think what it means is that, again, it comes back to the fact that the Court of Appeal will use its discretion in the circumstances of the case to either allow a methodology that's been put forward that seems reasonable and sufficient to be passed through, or to require, you know, that further detail is put forward, you know, where that's appropriate. But they're not going to be fine distinctions drawn on the basis of particular rules. The Court of Appeal will retain that. The adjustable act, I think, is a way of saying that discretion will come into a lot of
this. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering also if the takeaway cappuccino is going to take on the same significance as the Broad Act, because this is quite an interesting point, I think, where the defendants were saying if the losses to a particular class member could be argued to be de minimis, those losses, those class members ought to be stripped out of the class.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important point about the regime, because the whole purpose of the regime is to allow compensation to be dealt with on an aggregate basis, even where it's very small.
Mm-hmm.
And on when you aggregate all that together, it becomes a significant number. And that enables the proceedings to be brought. I shouldn't overlook the fact that these proceedings need funding. And so you need to be able to aggregate all the loss so that you make the proceeding viable. But also, and I think the Court of Appeal was very strong on this, you can't overlook the fact that small losses may be significant to class members. It's hard, obviously, to make it work. The whole purpose of the regime is to try and solve the problem that getting access to justice for small amounts is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't overlook the fact that it still may have significance to the individuals that are affected. So again, I think we ended up with a very sensible outcome on that. We will have to confront the issues of distribution when we get to the distribution of damages in these cases and have to find a solution. But there are plenty of methodologies for enable, again, you know, the adjustable acts, not rough justice, but practical justice,
yeah,
to allow not to get bogged down in the detail of, you know, assessing whether someone has, you know, is owed £3.50 or £4 in an individual case, but sometimes having a tariff amount, you know, at a sensible level, or allowing people just to put forward claims without, you know, full documentation if it's small amounts. Again, you know, this is all something where the court is going to retain some discretion to try and do justice in the circumstances of the case. But it will look different from an individual who has a sufficiently large claim, who brings a claim that has to prove the loss at a precise level. That's mm-hmm. not how this is going to work.
Mm-hmm. All of which is very much in keeping with the Supreme Court's judgment in
exactly
in merit.
All of this is a very practical approach, I think, by the Court of Appeal, which is all aimed at making the regime actually work, given that's what Parliament decided it wanted on the statute book. So I think, you know, the Broad Acts has come out of the closet as of late in quite a significant way. It's good that the Adjustable Acts have now met the Broad Acts. Because this is the only way you are actually going to make this regime work, is if you're prepared to, you know, as the Supreme Court made clear, use these principles of relatively rough justice.
Mm-hmm. And I think so. There are a couple of further grounds of appeal, Luke. Mm-hmm. One of which related to the cost benefit analysis that the CAT performed.
Yeah. So the third and fourth grounds of appeal were, I think, of less broad significance, but they are worth mentioning, because the cost-benefit challenge came up because when the tribunal certification stage was assessing the eligibility of the claims to be certified, it looked at all the factors, and there are seven factors, and on six of the factors it said that the balance weighed strongly in favour of certification, but it looked at the cost-benefit analysis in this case and said that it felt that given the ability of claimants to evidence their claims, the cost of the proceedings, that they felt that the balance, if you looked at that alone, would weigh slightly against certification. The defendants then looked at the actual cost of bringing the certification hearing, which had been very heavy because the defendants had taken lots of points against us, and said, well, that was greater than expected, so that should weigh even further mm-hmm. on the cost-benefit analysis, and that should be taken into account. And the Court of Appeal dismissed this ground fairly peremptorily, and it did so because it said that it's very important for the CAT to keep a close eye on the costs of proceedings, and that's a function of the CAT. But this challenge raised no new point of law for the Court of Appeal to deal with. And it was something that the Court of Appeal really didn't give a lot of credence to as a ground of challenge to certification to the Court of Appeal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. And then this final point, the Court of Appeal went through, I think, some of the authorities when it comes to 102 Chapter 2.
So, I mean, this, the final ground of appeal, just touching on exactly what was being argued, the defendants were saying that the abuse as it related to third-party sellers, you can buy a ticket from the train companies themselves or you can buy it through the train line, and they were saying that they didn't have any control over the third-party sellers, so they should be struck out. And there were also other types of fares where there were complications and they should be disregarded. There were arguments on both sides, and what the court held in relation to those kind of arguments, that these were all issues, they were factual issues that needed to be dealt with at trial. So again, not really appeal points. Those are examples of defendants taking points that I think, as a point of principle, shouldn't have been taken at the appeal stage. They should be points that should have been dealt with at trial, and the Court of Appeal saw it in that way. But the interesting discussion that you refer to is about the kinds of abuse that can qualify as abuses of dominance. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's given rise to, I don't want to overemphasize it, but I could describe it perhaps as a degree of consternation in some circles, or maybe manufactured consternation. People are saying that this kind of case shows a real extension of the categories of abuse. And I think what the analysis of the Court of Appeal demonstrates is that what we're seeing here is not a significant extension. The law as it stood before the Trains case, before the PT case, was that the categories of abuse are not closed. And this example of abuse, we see, you know, a case of, you know, failure to make a type of ticket sufficiently available so that it's not taken up. Very, very minimal take up of this type of ticket in comparison to what you would expect. That can qualify as an abuse. And that's a principled decision. And it doesn't mean that the floodgates are just open to any kind of abuse or any breach of the law qualifying as abuse of dominance. That's always been the law. And so I think as a take home from this case, I think we can see, I think it applies to the BT case as well. These are both good cases that should have been certified, out of which are coming helpful principles that are good for the regime in general. But it is not as if the playing field has suddenly been tipped in the claimant's favour in some kind of new way. This is just an articulation of what was the case all along. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of which is, I mean, it's a good read, yes. as you say, and going back to cases like Tetra Pak and saying, you know, the lack of transparency there was really was important, and looking at that in the context of non-price abuse.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, as both of you have said, I mean, how Green reached this very much in the European jurisprudence around Facebook and Deutsche Post, which is exactly what Roth did. So as you say, I don't think this is startling. It's just a use of the existing law.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you, Luke and Anthony and Nicola for discussing both the Google Play Store hearing and the Trains Court of Appeal judgment. As I said, there's been plenty going on in the collective action space, so you can expect another episode of the collective cast, I suspect, relatively hot on the heels of this one, dealing with some of those other developments as well. But thank you all very much.
Thank you.